Now, from Pod's Destroyer.
Captain, I was expecting it to be one of the historians with you. But a Vulcan?
Explain yourself, Mr. Scott.
Son?
I don't know what's going on, but the first officer of this ship will be treated with respect.
Captain, I assure you no one has ever treated me otherwise.
Who are you?
Well, I thought sure you'd know Thalen by now, Jim. He's been your first officer for 5 years.
Captain, I have come to the conclusion that this is not a game.
No, but if it's reality, what happened?
Hello, and welcome. To whom pods destroy. It is recording.
Yay.
A Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm starting with a hello because I've noticed that my hellos are a little bit understated. It's more like hello. And, you know, I just think we need a bit more
boomph,
boomph. And also it's Christmas. It's more or less the week before Christmas. So although this isn't a Christmas episode, we are full of Christmas cheer. At least I am. What about you, Derek Mantle? Are you full
hello,
of Christmas
hello, ho, 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 ho.
I believe the answer is yes. And you, Graham Sibley, are you full of Christmas cheer?
I am.
This is wonderful. And we're all wearing splendid T-shirts. Derek has belly written on his T-shirt.
In the wrong place.
In the wrong place. It's on his chest.
It's ironically on his chest.
It should actually say boobs. But it says belly. Graham is wearing an Incredible Hulk T-shirt, and I am wearing a Shut Up Wesley T-shirt. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Just setting the scene here. Just setting the scene.
So you're basically saying that we're in T-shirts. So are you sure this isn't summertime?
Well, I mean, as I said, you're not used to... You don't often come in the studio. This is sound... We're recording in Sound of Football studio, which is more or less going to be our permanent home now because the acoustics are just so much better.
They are lovely.
And it's an easier walk down to the pub and to the football from afterwards as well. So, but it does get warm in here, even in these cold climes. Anyway, let's talk about Star Trek because that's what we're here to do. And we're going to be talking about an episode from the animated series called Yesteryear. And this is because we're very excited about Star Trek Discovery Season 2, which is almost upon us, and Spock returns. And so we thought, let's have a bit of a Spock celebration, a Spockabration, and talk about a lesser-known, perhaps, episode of Star Trek, which is nevertheless an episode of some importance and weight, an animated series called from the animated series. And this is an episode, I think, Graham, that holds up, in my opinion, at least. I don't know what your opinion is, but in my opinion, this is an episode that, as a story, holds up along with any half-decent episode of TOS.
Oh, certainly. And considering that it's only, 25 minutes in length, it packs a hell of a lot in. I've seen plenty of hour-long episodes of Star Trek that flesh out something that does not contain anywhere near as much information as this one does, or story.
There is loads of story. There is so much story in this episode that they do acknowledge actually that they packed so much in that in some respects it's a little bit unsatisfactory. For example, Commander Thalen, the Andorian first officer, mm-hmm. in the alternative timeline, we never really kind of found out about him, did we?
No, we didn't find anything about him really, except no. that he was an honourable Andorian and he didn't have too much of a chip on his shoulder when it came to Vulcans, you know, that we find later on that you do in the Enterprise series, don't you?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, like, how much do you think the Enterprise Andorians was informed by just that one scene from Yesteryear? Because, I mean, like, previously Andorians, I mean, we'd had a bit about Andorians in Journey to Babel, mm-hmm. And we had a little bit more, but we had very little. So when they were putting Andorians together in Enterprise, they must have had so little to work on. They must have probably looked at Dorothy Fontana's Yesteryear and thought,
yeah, I suppose you're right there. I mean, obviously it's quite interesting that the character fits the role that Spock was supposed to have. So it's sort of like it puts them at an even keel, you know, as races as such. So, and as we know from Star Trek, it's massive fandom. You know, there would have been so much discussion about even these tiny little bits and pieces that
these
we all fill
snippets,
in.
That we build our own headcanon around. Yeah. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
You know, and of course you were saying that sort of like this episode is actually quite packed. You've also got at the beginning, you've got the Guardians of Forever.
Well, yes indeed. So this is it. I mean, funny, Memory Alpha call it a sequel to A City on the Edge of Forever, and I assume that they
call it a sequel to Journey to Babel.
Yeah, this is the thing. I mean, what do you think about that? Is it a sequel to anything, really, or is it just simply another story that is included in a very rich universe?
Well, the animated series is replete with callbacks.
Yeah,
throughout there, because you've got the triple sequel there. Mm-hmm. You've got another Mud episode.
Yeah,
you've also got a sequel to Shoreleaf there as well. So there are so many callbacks in that, and this one is just full of them. It's basically, I don't know how much input Fontana had with the sort of the writer's guidebook that they used to have, but it's like she's just taken everything out of it or added stuff herself and just run with it.
I mean, she wrote some of that stuff herself anyway. Yeah. I don't know whether she had any influence, but I mean, like, she would have had some influence on like the writer's Bible because she was a story editor for so long on the show.
Yeah.
And so she must have, so just by her body of work, would have contributed into that. Whoever
it would have been her job to make sure that the ideas that and character development fit with the complete story.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Dorothy Fontana, because Derek, I mean, I think that the thing about Dorothy Fontana is that this podcast should also act as a bit of a celebration of Dorothy Fontana and the work she did on those early seasons of Star Trek, the original series, and the world that she helped to build, which is the building blocks for the franchise going forward. I mean, I don't think she's a forgotten or unsung in any way, but I think that there are perhaps other figures in Star Trek that maybe are celebrated more than Dorothy Fontana.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that obviously there are other male figures. Perhaps more blokes. It is a bit of a case. And also what's quite interesting is that this is the only episode of the animated series that she actually wrote, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But I read that she'd actually she was in direct, one of the main producers of the whole series.
Yeah, she was. She was actually in charge of getting the writers in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she would have steered it. You know? In fact,
There's an argument to say that the animated series was her show.
Yeah.
And that she was effectively the showrunner of the animated series,
and I presume Roddenberry wasn't much to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, Roddenberry laid down some guidelines as to where we think it should be done, and Dorothy Fontana took that. So Roddenberry was very keen that the animated series take advantage of the fact that they are using animations, and therefore encouraged writers to use their imaginations and increase the scope of the stories in a way that budgets and in fact technological obstacles just simply prevented them from doing when they were making the original series in the 1960s. And indeed, if they'd still been making Star Trek, live action Star Trek, in the 70s. And I think that by and large, they did that very well on the animated series. I mean, it's a children's show made in the 1970s on a very low budget in animation terms by Filmation, a lot of people love Filmation cartoons, and fair play to them for doing so, because there is a beauty in the sparseness of their animations. But in others, we'll find it to be too cheap and it doesn't translate well, and I can respect that.
They call this the golden age children's American TV, because you had so many of these sort of like animated series, and Filmation was the big one actually, and obviously Hanna-Barbera, because I remember as a kid picking up the American comics, and they used to have like little spreads in inside of these comics where it actually showed the times that these shows were on. And Star Trek was in there, and Tarzan, and things like this that we finally got over here at some point.
A few years later. The thing about the animated series is that I'm pretty certain that actually this is probably the first Star Trek that I remember watching. I have very vague memories of when it came out. In the UK, listeners, it was first shown in the early 1970s on the BBC. Mm. And I would have been tiny. I would have been a very small person. I have vague memories of maybe watching it then, but then they could easily be memories that are conflated with maybe later in my life. Mm-hmm. So they're just not reliable enough. My first ever firm memories of watching Star Trek was when I used to watch the cartoon.
So I mean it's
for many fans it's an important series, I think.
And this is a very important cartoon, because this is the one that I remember most clearly from that time. And I haven't seen this in a good 30, 40 years.
Did you enjoy watching it?
I did, actually, yeah.
Because, I mean, when we talked about it, we only talked about this on Monday.
Yeah.
And I think that it might well be that you weren't in the room when Derek and I decided to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
And we maybe just forgot to tell you.
Yeah.
And you went, yesterday, isn't that a TNG episode? Yeah. You almost lost your shit, actually. Because I thought, we're not doing TNG on this show.
No.
But so you've only had a few days to digest it. What's your impression of it? I'm interested.
Well, I'd actually had seen a couple of animated episodes recently, just because of the fact of doing this podcast, and the fact that I've got Netflix now, and it just keeps showing up there, animated. All right, let's have a look at it. And the ones I'd seen, and they were just as I don't think, for want of a better word, clunky as I thought they would be. Because although they've got the original cast there, they are. It doesn't sound like they're actually all in the same room together. It sounds like they all just turned up, delivered their lines, and got out again.
Yeah, that is pretty much exactly how it was.
Yeah,
some of the stuff was actually recorded away. They didn't. I mean, they never convened. I don't think they ever convened in a studio. They all recorded them separately, and some of them in their own studio. I think William Shatner did some of his lines while he was out and about.
Right.
You know, had a tape recorder and would do it in a, say, in a hotel room and stuff like that if it was out working or stuff like that. So, yeah.
On the back of a pickup truck.
So there is, yeah, there isn't that interplay with the characters. The dialogue and the ideas are, all right, you say it's a kids' program, but they are for everyone to watch, aren't they, really?
Yeah.
The ideas are not really any different to what the show was, what the live action show was.
Mm.
And yeah, there is the opportunity to do some fancy things as well, but fancy things are also difficult to animate as well, so you do have a problem there.
Yeah.
We mentioned on the last episode, didn't we, about the force field belts.
Yes.
And they showed up in the animated series, because it means you don't have to redraw them. All you have to do is draw a little belt on people.
Yeah, and then just put the little ready break halo over them.
So it was things like that, the simple thing. Look, when I was recently reintroduced to the animated series was on a fantastic YouTube mashup video done by some guy who took the Ben Folds, William Shatner,
I've seen that
Common
vid.
People
that is
track and has spliced in a load of the animated series on there. And Derek, if you haven't seen this, I will show you.
We'll link up. Stick a link up on the if you go to whompodsdestroy.com right now, it'll be on there for you to watch.
Yeah, and it is fabulous, and it actually shows the beauty of the animated series, because actually what they did do was actually really celebrate what had gone on in the TV series. And it was obviously done by people with a genuine love for it. And obviously with people like Fontana involved and the original cast, you can forgive it, the clunkiness that surrounds it.
There's tons to actually dig into here, and of all of the episodes of the animated series, and some of them are poor, but this one is comfortably the finest, I think. And it's obviously a time travel episode.
It's
quite good because it starts off with the Garden of Forever, which they kind of also call the time portal as well.
I think I'm wondering if they were worried, did they really want any more problems from Harlan Ellison?
Well, maybe,
phoning him up saying, oh, they're taking my where's my money?
I'm sure that Harlan would have probably seen you. That was a dynamite script. It was a dynamite script. And now they're turning it into cheap cartoons. Rest in peace, Harlan, by the way.
I'm the only one who's not going to sully his name by trying to do a bad impression.
No, he's a beautiful man and the soul of a poet, as but yes, a man who knew the value of his work, shall we say that.
Yes,
and
indeed.
Fair play to him, because there aren't enough
because we all should.
He was right to know the value of his work. I mean, it's great. They've got that funky alien guy, this kind of griffin. And we should have researched this. They do have a name, those that guy, because they turn up again in later episodes of TAS. And it's a really nice sort of example, I think, of what Roddenberry was saying is yeah. like saying we would never be able to get a guy to dress a guy like that in a live action show.
Well, this is also, I think, to with do it. With the animators and where they get their influences from.
Because yeah.
that guy, there was a series of sort of 1960s horror type comics who have those characters with the sort of the hawk people. Griffin type look, and I think that that's actually where that sort of thing has been taken from. And I could probably do a little bit more research and get back to you about it, but I think that that's probably a lot to do with the animators. And right. there's other things influenced in there that I would actually going to say later on cool. about sort of influences. I mean, going, you know, rewinding a bit forward is that when you actually finally get to Volcom, and you have the environment that they're all walking around, obviously this time you actually see, for the first proper time, you see what it's like in a Vulcan house. Mm. And you see a lot of the alien sculpture and, you know, different sort of pieces and stuff like this. And I immediately occurred to me where that came from, those sort of designs and everything. And there was a excellent illustrator called Richard M. Powers, who did hundreds of... covers for books, and Harlan Ellison was one of his people that he actually authored for, and he did some wonderful in the 1950s and 60s designs, which probably inspired also some of the sort of Jetson sort of looks with a lot of those sort of unusual sort of shapes.
Mm.
And if you look at it now, there is a connection to Star Trek as well, and it actually goes to Gold Key, because he used to do Gold Key covers as well.
Right.
And Gold Key were the first comic company to do Star Trek. And they used to have painted covers.
They did. The glorious covers. Glorious those covers. Gold Keys, aren't they?
Yeah. And some of those covers are sort of inspired by Richard Powers. But Richard Powers actually didn't do Star Trek. He did Dr. Solar. And I'll dig out for you if you want to.
That's really interesting. So you've got this kind of creative connections taking place. Mm. Around that time.
Yeah, and there is a connection to Star Trek later on, because when IDW did a crossover with Star Trek with their other licensed characters and stuff, they did a thing called the Infection series. And on one of the covers, you could see they've done a Star Trek cover, and they've used the old Star Trek logo from Gold Key on it, so that's quite a nice little... But the actual illustration is a direct rip-off of a Richard Powers illustration. With Kirk and Spock in there, and it's, you know, so. But anyway, that going back to the sort of the design, you know, and the Vulcan, you know, it's brilliant to see that sort of obviously these animators are given a bit of freedom to interpret and bring stuff into it, and later on, well, earlier on, it's the first time you see. A Vulcan city as well in the distance.
That picture, that image of Spock on the ridge, looking down on Shikar, is a beautiful rendering.
Mm.
It's really quite gorgeous. Yeah, I mean, a lot is said about the filmation animation. It was very cheap, but that takes nothing away from the talent and the skills of the artist and the animator.
Well, the scope is what they wanted. Yeah, to
try and bring. I mean, it really was lovely, and we'd never in a million years have seen anything like that up to that point. I mean, maybe when they did the remastering and stuff like that.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, it's not up there with your kind of Albert Whitlock Mac paintings, but it would have had to have taken Al Whitlock doing another magnificent Mac painting.
Imagine how that would have been if he'd been involved in that.
Yeah, that would have been amazing if he'd been involved in that. The story is that Spock has to go back in time to a point in his childhood, and something's wrong has happened. He's gone back in time somewhere else, and while he was back in time somewhere else, it happened to coincide with the time that he was killed. Or not killed while out on walkabout, basically, and so he has to. That's a bit of a strange one. don't think we need to dwell too much on the connection there.
It just happens.
I don't know whether that's really how time travel works. But
well, wasn't it because the other two were looking at something else in Vulcan at the same time?
Yeah, they were existing at the same point in time, but elsewhere. So Spock was always preordained to go back in time and save his 10-year-old self. But as it happens, he then went back in time somewhere else.
When they flip the channel,
I'm pretty certain it doesn't work like that, but then time travel doesn't exist, so it doesn't really matter.
So it can work any way you want.
If it's as MacGuffins go, I'll buy it.
But it's quite quick, though, that sequence, so the idea you go straight into it.
Yeah.
Because as soon as
I just love this, is the thing about the animated series, is there's no preamble. I mean, we're straight into the plot straight away. It's like, yes, come on. And I mean, this is great, because we've got Mark Leonard coming back. And we've also got Amanda as well, which is voiced by Majel Barrett. I mean, how do we feel about the voiceovers? Because they got anyone who wasn't the existing cast was basically voiced by Jimmy Doohan or Majel Barrett for the most part. Occasionally, Nichelle Nichols would do extra. Not NPC characters, I suppose you might call them.
The first one that got me, obviously, was The Guardian of Forever.
Yeah. Yeah. That was not the same guy, was it?
No, but I think the thing is that James Doohan did have the range to do a lot of voices and not think immediately, oh, that's Jimmy Doohan. Majel Barrett does not have the range. No. I mean, she has a fabulous voice. She's great.
She does indeed.
And she has done numerous voice work on Star Trek.
Yes.
Throughout the years, throughout the decades.
And the voice of the computer for decades.
Yeah.
For a very long time.
Yeah. But you know, as soon as she opens her mouth as Amanda, you think, oh, that's Majel Barrett. And you don't get the same with Jimmy Doohan.
No, Jimmy Doohan had a versatile voice. Proper voice actor. Yeah.
But he wasn't as good as Malachi Throne, who did the original Guardian voice.
He wasn't as good. No, but I mean, in fairness, I mean that the Guardian of Forever voice from Sitting in the Dead Forever is wonderful.
And, question.
A question. Yeah.
A question.
So we get, and Mark Leonard comes back for it as well, which is also something of a treat. And it's nice to hear, and that must have cost him a bob or two to get him back in there. And it's great because it adds to the authenticity. And I think it's really artful how they managed to get in the seeds of the conflict between the two, between father and son, in a 20-minute short with a real sparsity of dialogue to work with.
Yeah.
And also with animations to be able to convey that emotion.
Yeah.
And okay, maybe at the time when you're watching it at that time, you might not pick up on it because, you know, you may have never watched Journey to Babel. You may have missed it when it was on. Or if you're a kid, you probably definitely didn't watch it. And you might not have picked up on those nuances, but they were definitely there.
You saved my son's life, Selleck. There is no way I can fully repay you for that.
Try to understand your son, Sarek of Vulcan. It will be repayment enough for me.
A strange request, but I will honor it. My home is yours if you pass this way again.
I think I shall not. Peace and long life.
Live long and prosper, cousin.
Or are we projecting those nuances on that? Is that what's going on?
I think fans can't help but project it onto there because if you know the stories so well, and you'll take what you learn from the films as well.
Yeah.
So from Star Trek 3 and Star Trek 4, those bits will come in there as well.
But is it accurate to say that Dorothy Fontana would have written that into that were there for us to find?
Yeah.
They are there.
She has a perfect understanding of the way the world works for them. She's got this all written down, and whether or not it's actually appeared in an actual episode or not.
Yeah.
This is the framework she uses to write these characters and to write these events. And so and when she explains it through the dialogue, the actors pick it up, they run with it, and then it's always a recursive process, though, isn't it? It's always about you give it to the creative people to create an episode, and then you get it back again thinking, right, okay, well, how do we build on from it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, was the Star Trek fandom quite well advanced at this sort of time?
I would say so.
So she would have been going along to conventions. So she would be talking to
conventions
people about
happened
what
in
they
the
liked,
early 70s.
Yeah, it was launched at a convention, the animated series.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
So there would have been that she would have been talking to people saying, well, why
yeah,
don't you
it's do possible, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's entirely likely, in fact.
I know a lot of the things about the animated series was it brought in a lot of suggestions from fan fiction. So things like the holodeck that we see in Practical Joker, that was something that was created in fan fiction rather than
from
the writers themselves.
Interesting, yeah, because then... Because the first episode of Star Trek Continues, which we've mentioned before, mm-hmm. the fan-produced series, has a holodeck in it. And I think probably initially that jarred with me. I thought, oh, that's a bit early. And then I watched that Practical Joker and I thought, oh, they have a holodeck in it. So actually it's perfectly consistent. I mean, there's an interesting connection also with the Kelvin timeline as well, because the... when we first meet 10-year-old Spock, he's being bullied by three of other Vulcans. And this is coming straight into J.J. Abrams uses this to introduce Spock to us in the Kelvin timeline movies in Star Trek 09. And so this episode has genuine influence and a legacy there. Yeah. And can't have not escaped his attention.
Well, we've discussed before about that gap between 1969 and 1987 when the Next Gen comes out, and the fact that all we've got is a few films to go on.
Yeah.
And if you were a fan like we were growing up then, it's anything you could take, and so the animated series was
would have been poured over.
Exactly,
watched and rewatched, I would imagine. I mean, even then, in fairness, because it wouldn't have been available. It might have been available commercially, the animated series, but I mean, it's not an easy thing to. It might not have been, and not an easy thing to actually watch. So a lot of this is kind of hidden Trek, and of course, people dismiss it because it's for kids, and so maybe think, well, it's not really worthy. Yeah.
The UK never repeats. It's very seldom repeats American. Cartoons.
Even back then. So it wouldn't have been on. It wouldn't have been on again.
I don't know. It's Flintstones episodes.
There are some honourable. There are, of course, some honourable exceptions.
That's a different kettle.
But Flintstones is top quality.
Yeah,
so,
and Top Cat and things like that.
That's because that whole thing about Top Cat is there's only been about 6 episodes, isn't there? Yeah. But everyone thinks they're about 70 because it was on all the time. Dorothy Fontana deliberately wanted to introduce a message for kids, and to also to educate children on loss. And so we see that, don't we, in the pet Saylat Aichaya, who sadly Spock has to make a decision to euthanize.
I wanted only to help Aichaya. He was my father's before he was mine. To lose him.
A Vulcan would face such a loss without tears.
How?
By understanding every life comes to an end when time demands it. Loss of life is to be mourned, but only if the life was wasted. Aichaya's was not.
This is a touching scene, really. I think that whole sequence about how angry he is and how difficult he's having with his heritage and with his makeup and how he is, and there's a lot it's quite relatable, I think, for kids, particularly for kids who perhaps grew up and and felt not themselves and maybe were bullied at school and maybe didn't feel as if they were like other people. And I think there's a lot to identify there. But I also think that there is that kind of this idea of loss is something that happens. One day you will lose your pet. One day, and of course, the implication is one day you will lose a member of your family, someone close to you. She deliberately wanted to incorporate that message into there without it being, necessarily too obvious that that's what was happening.
Well, it's not obvious at the beginning because young Spock goes off to get a healer. And you think, he's going to make it back in time,
And then they've got this little sort of like 2-minute vignette within it where Spock suddenly has a new crisis to deal with, and that's to get a healer. And we're all kind of thinking the healer will come by and save the pet. And it doesn't happen. Obviously, this is a very Spock-heavy episode. Hardly any Jim Kirk in it at all. There is actually an episode of the animated series in which in which Kirk doesn't appear in it at all.
Oh, really? Which one's that?
It's called The Slaver Weapon, and it's set on a on a shuttlecraft, and Spock is the commander of a landing party. And it's based upon a short story by the science fiction author Larry Niven.
Mm.
So if you haven't seen that, that's definitely up there.
So that shows you the quality of the writers that they were getting.
People
in
were willing to, people willing to write for that show, even then. And it's really, it's funny because by contrast, say Dorothy Fontana also wrote a book called wrote the original story for a two-part episode of the original Battlestar Galactica. Which she, and they, by the time they'd finished with the rewrites of it, she hated it, and she took her name off of it and replaced it with a pseudonym, and in the nicest, most professional possible way, made it fairly clear around the circuit, the writer's circuit, that she was unhappy with how this had been gone down. And as a consequence, no sort of like established science fiction writer would write for Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, I mean, such is the weight of Dorothy Fantana's opinion, I think, as well as all that. And also, it just goes to show you just how you can mess these things up if you're not careful. Why don't we just close out this podcast just by making some reflections on how this episode maybe, you know, fleshes out the character of Spock and how we understand him. Because we do learn a lot about Spock in the TOS because he's a major character. But do you think this episode fleshes out the character even more?
I think it certainly helps inform the fan fiction that comes out between even in the short period between the animation series, and the motion picture, which was only about 4 years, wasn't it? I suppose 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
But of course, there's a load of stuff that comes out on the fan circuit in that time, and a lot of it is building up on the established characters and established races there were at the time.
Mm.
Obviously, by the time The Next Generation comes around, it goes off into different directions because they introduce a lot more races and a lot more characters. So but this period here is where you've only got Vulcans and Klingons essentially to write about. You've got very little information on Andorians and Tellarites and the other ones there. But really, the fans really latch onto the Klingons and they latch onto to the Vulcans. So any source material is
going to get used, isn't it?
And I think you see a lot of that here. Most of the stuff we get in this episode is referred to before. Spock's pet is referred to.
Yes, in Journey to Babel.
Yeah.
Which was written by Dorothy Fontana.
Yeah. So it's nice to see it there. And so it's not as if we're actually being presented with new stuff. It's more of a
refined.
It's not a refinement, or it's just really established, saying, look, this is it. This is how it was.
But it's also, it represents the moment in Spock's life where he chooses a certain path.
Yes.
And that is a significant moment. The Spock character that we know and love and understand is the way he is because of this specific moment.
Yeah.
And it's a moment that his older self actually has a direct influence on, which is really interesting.
And of course, we get another tie-in of this when we come all the way up to Discovery, don't we? So with decisions to be made about taking one path or another.
Exactly.
So
I mean, Spock seems to meet these kinds of crossroads. I mean, I'm assuming from the small amount of what we've seen that Spock is, because there's in the trailer Spock appears to be smiling, which is a very nice touch, actually. We'll talk about it in the next episode, that will expand upon that. But he is a character that meets certain crossroads. You know, I mean, motion picture,
and he seems
to
meet himself a lot as well.
He does a fair amount of
that. If you go to the Kelvin timeline, obviously Leonard Nimoy is there as well.
Of course, because that's interesting. I hadn't put that together, of course, because we have like older Spock from another coming in to help.
Is he the giant one from
the Infinite Fall? That's not such a good episode in my opinion, although it is written by the great Walter Koenig, so it can't be too angry. I think we are going to wrap it there, guys, unless I've missed anything about this episode that we really ought to be talking about.
Well, you could quickly rewind right to the beginning with the Guardian of Forever, when Spock and McCoy jump out of the time portal, and the thing is that the first reaction is, who's that? Who's that with you? And then nothing is said until they get you know, I think it's McCoy, isn't it? McCoy says, "Who's this?" And obviously, they must have some sort of discussion about this new guy who's just popped up. And then, and it's like until you get to the Enterprise, it's a case no one's actually thought that there is something really badly wrong until Scotty says something.
They think it's a joke, don't they?
Yeah.
They think, oh, so I thought we thought they probably think it's McCoy playing a.
It's
McCoy Spock banter.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's gone horribly wrong, but in fact, it isn't McCoy Spock banter.
As Terry said. As MacGuffins go,
I know.
Yeah,
it's fine, but
yeah, and
but it's quick as well.
Yeah, I mean, also because you've got so much plot that you do, and I mean, in fairness, the episode is disjointed, and we have bigged out this episode big time. But if you do look at it objectively, it's a 20-minute mid-70s animated series, and it isn't any more than that. Don't get under any illusions that this is a masterpiece.
No,
but it is an extremely enjoyable way to spend 20 minutes, and it is an authentic Star Trek story.
One question that we could ask ourselves is, if this was an Enterprise story, how many episodes would it have taken up?
Oh my god. It would have been a four season arc. It depends on the which seasons it would have been in, but if it had been in the full season, if it was a Manny Koto episode, then it would have been five episodes long. Oh my god. It would have been, well, it's funny you should say that, because the Vulcan Forge where Spock goes into, there's an episode called The Forge, isn't there? And back on Vulcan. So they use that setting for... Well, and yeah, it is a multi-story. They're all like three or four episodes long, those arcs there. So actually, you've already answered that question, because that did kind of happen. Yeah. We meet Surak, don't we? And T'Pau and that. It's actually, in fairness, it's a decent story. But like all of those Enterprise episodes back then, it could have been done a lot quicker.
25 minutes.
Could have been easily done in 25 minutes. Yeah, and it wouldn't have been. Yeah. Anyway, let us draw a veil on proceedings. Let's get back in our time port. We're going to wrap up now. Thanks very much for listening. Until next time, thanks very much, Terry DeFone, and from Graham Sibley, and from Derek Mantle. It's goodbye.
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 Well, well, well. So you two finally got back from your vacation. Well, you've been running all of Orion's creation. I've been running the annual crew physicals. You're the last ones.
Welcome aboard, Mr. Spock.
And never mind the chit-chat. I've got my medical scanners all set up for Vulcan. I have to recalibrate every time I run a physical on you, Spock.
Dr. McCoy, you do not know your good fortune. If the times were different, you would have to recalibrate for an Andorian.
Well, what's that supposed to mean? If that was supposed to be a joke, Spock, I have to remind you, Vulcans don't tell jokes.
Times change, Doctor. Times change.
Who's this guy?
That's, Hello, sorry, who are you?
I'm Derek.
Okay, all right.
So you've been messing around with the portal again.